Here I'm walking through a field and I'm thinking about a girl just a few years younger than me that was stabbed to death.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America, and each one is called a cold case.
She said, "I think my dad could be responsible. I think he killed them."
These are some of those rare cases.
Cold Case Files, the podcast. Don't miss a moment. Subscribe now on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or at PodcastOne.com. And don't forget to watch or DVR Cold Case Files, the TV show, every Thursday at 10 on A&E.
And welcome to Dr. Who Podcast. All the usual stuff. Check out the website. Check out the other pods that are out there. Me and Bob Forrest. Me and Dr. Spaz. Me and Mr. Corolla. Also, the Adam and Dr. Drew show.com, where you can get that show. But today, by, I want to say, popular demand, and I don't mean to say that to sound like it's a platitude, literally demand. Previously on episode 275, Wes Chapman, there was such an overwhelming response to that. We need to give a part two. And you,
I'm flattered. It's,
and you, in part awesome. One, said you've only scratched the surface, that the real craziness is to come, which I think I probably went into denial when you said that and blocked it out because I was like, well, it's not possible.
Right.
After the story you told. We will sketch the old story, in case people didn't hear that. I'm going to sketch out your sort of – it's not really a CV or list, it's a brief list of accomplishments. He's presently the founder of A Human Project. Started in 2013. You can check out ahumanproject.com. We'll talk about what that's all about. You can also follow Wes at weschapman.com. You can see his Twitter handle at Wesley D. Chapman. Wes worked at Microsoft, Verizon, A&E. He received multiple so-called App of the Year awards from Apple. And he's also worked in multiple other media outlets, including ABC, Forbes, CBS, TechCrunch, and more. And you also hold some patents on several medical advancements. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, in the app world, we did some really cool stuff with app technology and medical diagnostics, that kind of fun stuff to understand the human body.
Future coming, right? There's still more of that coming.
Yeah, there's a ton of that coming.
Yeah.
So just people knowing is – I mean, knowledge is power. I know people say it's not, but I think it is. I think knowledge is power. You have to implement that power for sure, but – you know, knowing is a massive piece. So,
all right. So let's go sketch out the previous story.
Okay. I'll give you the quick rundown for those that haven't heard it. We got to, I believe, like age 9-ish, 10-ish in the first episode. The quick version is I was abandoned by my biological father when I was 1. I was abandoned by my biological mother when I was 6.5. Between the ages of 1 and 17, I was abused in just about every way you can imagine – physical, emotional, spiritual, sexual, the whole nine yards. And I, before the age of 16, attempted suicide 12 times. So this
– your first was what age?
The first documented suicide attempt was at 4.5 years old.
Mm. What did you do?
I ran out in front of a car screaming, "I want to die." Mm. And that's when the internal struggles of the, you know, four walls of my home were started to get exposed. But then, of course, they only got so deep with all the red tape and bureaucracy and everything else that followed. But that was the start of my medicated journey, my labels, that was the start. And you know, we dove into a lot of that in the first episode of just talking about
that. Yeah, please
go
back. It's episode 275 if you want to hear it. It's very intense. A couple things left. I'm left with, I want to just ask before we go on, which is for some reason this episode with you and your siblings being held upside down on a clothing hanger and being held at knife point and then subsequently sexually abused in the same episode.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. It's just like that. That to me just like – it overwhelms my brain's ability to manage. So it sort of stays with me as a traumatic memory, just even thinking about it.
That was a very traumatic experience in my life because it was a moment where I thought I could help my brothers and sisters, and I actually became more of a problem with them. You know, I became more of
– you incited more stuff.
Exactly, and created more anger in him, which then made him have to get more control over my siblings. It was just this pattern of – now I know how to handle those situations, but at the time, it being, you know, 12, 13 years old, you don't know how to handle that.
And you then said that this guy worked for the Catholic Church and that they sort of took over his, quote, treatment. But I still don't understand how this guy walks the earth without there being legal something.
I really don't understand a lot of it. I mean, I did. There was a lot of alienated that happened because I, at 16, became very vocal and saying, like, this can't continue. I went to my biological mother and said, you can't keep allowing this to happen, which created a rift between me and my siblings because there still was that biological bond. Like, that was their dad, right? And so for a while, he was completely separated. For a while, there was zero contact. You know, my mom got enough proof. There was enough conversation. My sister came forward. Everyone came forward as a family and said, this is happening. And so there was this time period where he was gone. He wasn't involved in our lives.
But he was with the Catholic Church pedophile camp or something. Or whatever.
He was still a janitor at the school at this point because we hadn't opened the legal proceeding, the legal case. And so, you know, once we started going down that road, there were a lot of habits. There were a lot of things that were formed. And I don't want to paint my mom in a bad light, my biological mother, so I'm not going to go into the details, and that's why on this type of thing. I mean, you and I could talk off air, that's fine, but she did the best she could under the circumstances that she knew and where she was in life. But there were some habits that were created where she was dependent on my stepfather. And rather than putting her foot down and saying, you know, we now know that you've done these things and my little girl has come forward, my son has come forward, like we're not continuing this relationship. She didn't do that. She continued leaving the door open for him.
Did she come from horrible abuse herself?
No, she was a runaway.
But people run away from abuse.
Well,
almost without exception.
Her father was probably, and I don't know all the details because I wasn't there, but from what I understand, her father was very neglectful and very abusive in that light, where he didn't really even want to acknowledge her as a child, as his child. So I'm assuming there was some definite abuse from that angle, but I wasn't there. I don't know. I've never had any detailed conversation. Again, just piecing some of my family genealogy together. But that was the moment where once she allowed him back in, after kind of the you're out, don't ever come back, we're done with you, once she let him back in, I think that created a lot of chaos in my siblings' minds of like, wait, I thought we were protected. Now we're not. Like, he's back. And he actually ended up taking my little brother on a weekend vacation, which my little brother came back and he was never the same.
Ooh.
So only assuming I wasn't there, but something happened. And then my siblings started to unravel in their stories. And I'll never forget being at the courthouse with my little sister, ready to go in and testify, and she basically freaks out. And the thing that had happened, though, is because of all of this conversation, there were other families at the school that came forward saying, we've had suspicions, we've had, you know, conversations, we've wondered what's been going on. That led to an open investigation, but it was handled internally. So the internal investigation led to, oh, there's something there, but we're not really going to dive into what it was. And so we're going to do some rehabilitation and he's no longer going to be a janitor at the school. So they put him as a caretaker to the property across the street from the school.
Good boy.
So, you know, and again, this is in early 90s. So this is kind of the start of the whole Catholic exposure and all that fun stuff. So lots of different angles in it. And then really for me, it was never about justice. It was never about getting back. It was really – wasn't. I wanted to protect my siblings. That was the only thing I cared about at this point at 16 is just like I want to help them. I got out, so I want to help them, and I feel like I'm in more power now than even when I was 12 and 13, and we had this momentum happening. And once they got out – because they did. They never – after that period of time, they had very limited contact. My sister ended up joining some volunteer missions and kind of went to South America, did a bunch of stuff. My brother did a bunch of different things. Like, they got out. I don't think they ever got all the help that they probably needed, but they got out. And, you know, from what I understand now, my brother's actually like has a family and things are working. So that was the goal. It wasn't retaliation.
Did they talk about these experiences?
No, we don't. I mean, it's just one of those things where it's not a part of a conversation. I hope someday that will happen. I hope someday that this type of an interview will land somewhere that somebody picks it up and hands it to them and says, you know, and if you're listening right now, like, let's talk about this. It's not, we don't have to hide from it anymore. But my goal wasn't retaliation to him. It was protect my brothers and sisters. And that happened. So
what if their memories are actually different? They actually have a different memory.
That would be interesting. That would be very interesting. I mean, we had a lot of conversations at the time as siblings. We had a lot of kind of closed door, the three of us having conversations and consoling each other and talking about it. My biological brother, who's mentally handicapped, he couldn't process any of it. So he doesn't have memory, which is probably really, really, really great for
him. Was he the object of much of this?
A lot of it. Boy. A lot of the really disgusting things happened to him because he just didn't – he didn't know right from wrong. He didn't understand that concept.
All right. Well, let's bring it forward. You're now at age nine or so, right?
Yeah. So now at age nine, things are looking up. Things are looking great. I'm living with this woman who is loving me.
That's your grandmother.
Right, who I call mom. I'm living with her, and she loves me. And that's a new word for me. That's a new concept for me. And it's exciting. It's energetic. It's fun. And as a kid, I pushed it. You know, how do you really love me? So there's a lot of, things I did from, you know, may or may not almost burning down buildings to may or may not stealing a lot of money to may or not being a bully at school, right? Like I kind of released a lot of my anger into the world and also testing her. Like, are you going to stay there? And now in my work—
Were you aware that that's what you were doing at the
time? No, not at all. Now in my work, I see it all the time.
You just saw that as acting out at the time. Or you just didn't, whatever. You were just acting out.
I was just being a kid, in my opinion, of just— I had a shitty childhood, you know, and even when people would come up to me, I remember saying, like, you don't know who I am. You don't know what I've gone through. This very victim, right? Like, I have the right to act like this
because I was a victim.
Because I was this position, yeah.
Had Dog the Bounty Hunter gotten into this yet?
No.
He comes along later.
He comes along much later.
Okay, right.
Yeah, like 20 years later.
Oh, my gosh.
So
he was the biological father, again, for people that haven't heard the previous episode.
Right, right. So it's the turn, the sharp left that everybody gets on.
The record goes.
Yeah, right. So we're in this state. Things are moving forward. I'm feeling better. I have somebody that loves me. Tons of residual side effects from the medications I'm on, the constant up and downs. Oh, yeah. Still on the meds. Still on the ups and downs. You know, didn't know anything that we know now about biology, about natural medicine. Nothing. Literally just like going to counseling sessions every Tuesday, Thursday, doing play therapy every Monday, Wednesday, doing Big Brother every Friday.
Big Brother, the Catholic Big Brother?
Big Brother, Big Sister kind of thing, yeah. So,
is that helpful to you?
It was different. It was never helpful. Helpful, yes. Consistent, no. And that's my biggest thing that I tell people now is if you're going to help, be consistent. Mm. You know, a lot of good-hearted people will go and do like a thing with kids. It's not what they need.
The lack of consistency just reaffirms their views of abandonment.
Just reaffirms the abandonment and the neglect and the issues.
And by the way, consistent, you mean over years.
Years of time. Yeah. And it, you know, we'll get into the story, but it was one person who did that actually – you talk about the one and I do as well – I think there's many ones, and there's certain ones along the way, right?
Yes. And the data shows that a single positive relationship outside the home can change the trajectory.
Exactly.
It has to start at age eight. It has to stay to young adulthood. Yeah.
Exactly. And that trajectory can change, and there can be other ones that help through the evolution.
For sure. And by the way, the problem is that the initial one – has got to stay, or the child will start rejecting the other one.
Exactly.
Because you know the one I was counting on left me. Therefore, I can't trust any of you guys.
Exactly. And we've seen that happen, and that's what a lot of our programs do is educate people on being a volunteer, being there of service. So, at nine, going through all this, things are looking up, and my mom starts dating a guy, who. It was really interesting.
Hang on a second. You're with the grandmom.
Grandma.
But you're also with the mom.
No. Sorry, I'm with mom. But
you have grandma around.
I'm with who I call mom.
Oh.
I'll say bio mom from now on.
Okay.
So
okay
I'll say
okay.
bio mom. I know. Gets a little crazy. So I'm with who I call mom. And she starts dating, kind of starts having a life, you know, but about a year and a half she didn't because I was a lot. Mm. But she starts dating again, and I'll never forget the first time this guy shows up. I open the door and he's like, "Hi, you must be Wesley." And I'm like, "Hi, you know. And we'll just call this guy Harry, okay? You must be Harry." And we do our thing, and I look at him, and there was just this overwhelming gut feeling of, fuck no. Like, I am not letting you in my house. So he's like, "Is your mom here?" And I'm like, "Actually, she left on a date with another guy."
Oh.
And I close the door, right? Swear to God, this is 100% true story. My mom comes out, and she's like, "Hey, was Harry here?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, he just left." And she's like, "What happened?" And I was like, "You're on a date with another guy." And like, nonchalant walk into my room, and she's like, "What the heck did you just, you know?" She's freaking out because this is a guy she really liked, blah blah blah. And he ends up like throwing a huge fit, okay, like massive. She ends up having to like say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Wes has got some things, we're going through it, da 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 da." But he was a total jerk about it. But she was, I don't say desperate, but I think desperate's the only word I can put, to have an outside relationship,
yeah,
to get
sure.
back into life. You know, she had given up her whole life to bring me in, and this was kind of a moment where she could at least go on a date. That was my first experience with Harry. well, Harry ends up being in my life for a very long period of time. And I think in all the interviews I've done, which is getting close to the thousand, I've never talked about this chapter of my life because people get so like, let's just talk about 0 to 10, right? 0 to 8.
And that, to be fair, it's pretty dramatic, 0 to 10.
But
and it's also where the most intense children are so open, you know, so affected by trauma.
Right.
But we certainly – it continues after that plenty.
It,
so.
It does. And it's interesting to me because I say it over and over again is that from the age of 1 to 17, I was abused. But no one ever asks me like what was the abuse, you know, in the in the time, because I wasn't sexually abused after the age of 7. So –
well, we don't care then.
Right. Exactly. It's like, okay, it's no abuse.
You know, another thing about the sexual abuse, before we get into the next, like delaying it, I'm too traumatized thinking about the old stuff. But it one of the things that we sometimes see is that sexual abuse by a male child messes with their sexual orientation. They get confused.
Right.
And did you ever have any stuff like that?
I didn't. Mm-hmm. I'm very attracted to my wife.
Women.
To my.
Yeah. So I could tell that just being around you guys. And so it struck me. I thought, huh, I wonder how that didn't happen. It doesn't have to happen, I guess, but at least usually it makes young males confused. Like, what? Did I do that? Male kind of wants to be responsible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
there, I mean, if we want to dive into the psychological side of it, there was Playboys used in a lot of our abuse to see. So I don't know if that was.
Oh, that's interesting.
Impressioned.
Yeah, yeah. I bet it was.
So because I had a lot of pornographic.
Well, it's interesting that's where your head goes, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of think about that.
I had a lot of pornographic nightmares where when I was very young, and my mom, not bio mom, my mom talks about them. I would wake up in cold sweats at like 9, 10 years old and just talk about like seeing naked girls, naked women. And so I don't know if that just imprinted that was part of the sexuality. I don't know. I've never really analyzed it.
Do you feel like creating sexual compulsions or anything? Because
usually
it does.
I mean, I like to be active.
Yeah, yeah. But are you like your wife has trouble keeping up with you kind of active? Or?
Well, that's a Chapman curse. Like all of
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I understand. But
I don't know.
I'm just saying. That could,
you know. She might be super happy right now that you're figuring this out because, you know.
But if I had to, you know, put in together sort of the kind of stimuli that a young brain is exposed to, I would think that would – plus, emotional abuse in a male oftentimes sort of creates that stuff. So it just would make sense that it would. So,
yeah.
Jody, you're off the hook. It's not your fault.
It's back to my damn childhood. 7 times a day is not enough. So anyway, so here he comes into my life and he's a manic depressant. We did not know that for years and years and years, but he's a manic – every possible stereotype you can possibly think.
Is he using, drinking?
He was religious, so he did not use that, but he used religion in a way that protected him and also insane amounts of abuse through religion.
Okay, so something called religious abuse.
Exactly.
You're aware, yeah.
Exactly.
So
that's why I say, again, even spiritual abuse, again, people don't really tap into that.
It's like,
these are some deep things that we're not talking about, and that's why I wanted to dive into this, because I knew we would go there. So for the next 13 years of my life, I was 9 and he didn't get out of my life till I was 17. So do the math. But he was in my life consistently and became the only father, air quotes, that I knew. And there were a lot of positives to that. He was an amazing handyman. Anything I know how to do is because of him. So there's definite benefits. But the abuse was insanely traumatic. Little simple things that – not simple, but just to give an idea of it is that we were roofing once in the middle of July, and it was one of the hottest summers in record. It was like 102, 103, and we're roofing. And if you've ever done roof, you have to tear off, and then you put down black paper, and then you put down tar. If it's 103, it's like 140 on the roof.
It's what Adam always talks about as absolute torture.
Yes.
Roofing in the heat.
It's hell. And
Only thing you liked less, I'd say, would you guys agree with me, was doing earthquake rehab under a house with a coffee can. Digging with a coffee can.
Jeez. So, wow. Yeah. I haven't done that. But, one time I had made a mistake while roofing, and I hadn't done it correctly. And he made me put my finger down and showed me, like, what it is, basically his thing. This is what it is to be a man. And he would intentionally put my thumb on that and then take a hammer and smash my thumb. And then other times I had lost a pair of shoes while we were roofing. Normal kid stuff, right? And I lost a pair of shoes, couldn't find it, and we were late to get onto the roof. And so he made me barefoot roof for like an hour. So my feet were totally fried. And I mean, there, we could go on and on and on about some of these things that he would do. He trapped me underneath a home once when we were doing some plumbing work. He was a licensed plumber, and so it was a lot of like plumbing. And he was a huge guy, like 6'4", 6'5", was not an exaggeration. He would put water heaters on the back of – on his back and walk them up to people's apartments, and just a very, very buff dude. And he looked – like amazing. Like my mom and him were a perfect couple. They looked beautiful. He was a high-ranking official in the church. Everyone loved him. But when those doors closed, he was insanely abusive physically and emotionally, and both to myself and my mom. And here's where the story – here's where it's really weird is that at this time I had learned love, right? I had seen this unconditional love from mom, and I had understood how – And very few things choke me up except for this, is that I understood how much she loved him and how desperately she wanted it to work. Mm. And I also knew that I had totally, quote unquote, from a child's protective perspective, destroyed her life. And that she had, right? She was going to retire. She was at the twilight, like she was at her twilight. She was just going to have this amazing life and she'd worked so hard, blah, blah, blah. And here I came, right? She had to take care of me. I never told her any of the things that were going on. We'd go off on work sites. Things would happen. She'd ask me, like, oh, I messed up, or oh, this happened, or oh, that happened. And I protected him for years.
To protect her.
To protect her. And we actually just a few weeks ago, she came and visited me, and we're getting ready to write the book. And so, you know, she's kind of helping with some of the stuff. She took journals of every day of my life. So I've got all these amazing, you know, from her perspective, and then I've got mine. So we're like putting all this together.
Even this phase that we're talking about?
Yeah.
And was she surprised to find out he was abusive?
100%. Mm. And she found out in –
Do you think you did the same thing with your biological mother and the – that guy?
I'm sure I did. Yeah. I'm sure there was some element of, yeah, of protection, because I was very protective of my siblings, like insane. I still am to this day. Like people ask me all the time, why'd you start a human project? The surface level is, oh, I wanted to, you know. No, like there is a very almost in that hero's journey, there's always that one person the hero couldn't save, and it motivates them to make sure they save everybody else, right? Whether it's a parent, whether it's a world, whether whatever, it's always the same. And to me, it's my siblings. It's this moment of like, I couldn't save them. I couldn't protect them from all of that. So, you know, now I've taken that, like, I'm going to go protect a billion kids. And so it's definitely a motivator. So I could see that that was either part of my core identity. And so I've done that along the entire journey.
The protecting thing.
The protecting thing, yeah. But
is that something you try to pull out of people?
Mm-hmm.
Again, people that don't know, a lot of Wes's mission is to flip the victim to a hero.
Right.
And when you're trying to help them find that heroic motivation, do you talk about this? Like,
yes,
the person you couldn't save?
The person I couldn't save, especially, wow, with youth. Especially with youth, because it's something that they
– what if it's themselves?
They can – exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. It's something that they can see in themselves.
And no, so maybe they couldn't – oh, they couldn't say it themselves,
right,
and
so,
they see it externalized.
Exactly. So
heavy.
So they can turn around and realize like – I can, you know, that there is, there are options, there are people who care. And so anyway, so going through this, and because I really do want to dive into like some principle stuff that people can take from this, not just talk about my story, but that was some of the most traumatic experiences in my life. And because, yes, all the stuff in my childhood and the science, and I get all of that, but there were so many behavioral things that it wasn't till later that I had to start realizing. There was a lot of self-worth issues. He told me all the time, I don't have to be your father. Your real father didn't even love you enough. Like, you're not going to have a life. You're going to end up marrying. You know, he would always talk about how he's going to marry some short, fat girl, which is in no way relevant to anything, but just it was a way of demoralizing me and making me feel worthless that, you know, I was.
Is he still around? Is he in your mom's life?
Or? No, not at all.
And you, here's, is he in yours? Or you gone back to.
Nope. Mm. And there's a fun story there. But what ended up happening? So, go through all of this turmoil, all of this abuse, doing all this stuff.
Did it get worse over time?
Got insanely worse.
Were you ever fighting back?
I started to a little bit, but I'm a small dude, right? For those of you who don't see me, I'm like 160 and 5'11". So like he's 6'4", I don't know, 230, 240,
yeah,
big dude. And like, right, there was no fighting back. There just wasn't. The few times I would, it just hurt worse than just kind of dealing with it and letting him have his little temper tantrum, as I called him, and then moving on. Mm. But what ended up happening is, and I think we talked about it in the first episode, is that I had this moment where the doctor said, you know, your internal organs, all this stuff, these medications. So I had this moment of like, I'm going to figure this out. And part of that taking back the control, and we talked about control versus, like, you know, the control for me was more on a psychological level of owning some of this stuff so that I could be in control for the first time instead of allowing everyone else to. When I started doing that, I realized the things that he was doing to me were not okay. Because there became a point where I was like, this just must be what a dad does. I haven't really had a dad who wasn't abusive. So maybe fatherhood is supposed to be abusive, right? I'm not sitting there talking to my high school friends about, like, does your dad beat you up? You know, like, you don't have those conversations. So there was a point where I just thought, this is normal. This is how it's supposed to be.
The original – when the abuse got started, did you just think that's how males treat kids?
Yes. Yeah. It was very much like this is just
And
must
then it
be,
became this is dad.
This is dad's yeah. and this is just how it is. And so
– at least he's not sexually abusing me.
Right. And yeah. and there was at least – the other thing was at least – because there were good moments. Like there were camping trips. I'd never had that. Father and son camping trips. Like that was amazing to me. There
oh, just
were,
the two of you?
Yeah. Like, you know.
Well, it makes kind of more weirdly conflicted though, doesn't it?
Hugely yeah. weirdly conflicted.
Yeah, that's because, probably what's so traumatizing to right? you because you were so in need mm-hmm. of that and then it would just get.
And when we were oof. Around other people and we were like a camping trip, he was being amazing because we were surrounded by his peers, right? So his peers were there. So we were in this moment of him just being completely engaged and being awesome. So it was – and my mom would have the same experiences. They would be locked in a room for 2 or 3 days fighting. And then they would have this moment of like, okay, we're going to work it out. And then they would go somewhere and he would be amazing. Mm. He would be perfect. He would be a gentleman. He's the one that taught me open doors for ladies. He's the one that taught me, you know, on the first date, you do this. Like there was so much positive reinforcement in his behavior to hide who he really was as a person that it was insanely conflicting.
Do we know what happened to him?
Yeah, I can tell that okay. you know, as we go along. Okay. So here I am waking up, 17 years old. He is still part of my life. We were putting in a new bathroom in our home, and we were replumbing it, doing everything. And my mom wanted a jet tub. She's always wanted a deep soaking jet tub. So we were putting that in. And the way that he taught me how to put in a tub is that, you know, you build this little system, lever system, where you have a ply, you know, a piece of wood, whatever, and then somebody stands on the one end as you're installing it, and then he would get up underneath, connect all the stuff, and then when you're done, you know, you release the piece of wood, and there you go. Simple little lever, whatever. Well, he's underneath there, and he asked for some wrench that I hadn't ever heard of before. And at this time, like, I knew the terminology.
How old are you?
17.
Okay.
I knew the terminology. I knew all these different things, but he'd asked for something I hadn't heard in a way I hadn't heard. And I'm like, I don't, which one do you want? Like, you know, kind of give it to me again. I'm not sure which one you want. And he made some comment, like, stop being an idiot, or just some pretty simple comment, but it was like, it was a trigger.
Yeah.
So I'm standing on this board and I'm seeing him on his back underneath this tub. And I'm like, I'm in power right now. And I'm going to take control of the situation, right? So this is like my new motto is like, I'm not going to be a victim anymore. I'm actually going to live my life and take control. So as he is belittling me, I'm kind of like, you know what? No. So I step off of the lever and the tub falls down on him, which he's a big dude. So it didn't like hurt him, but it still sure hurt him, right? And so I'm like, oh shit, kind of in this moment of like, this is not going to end well. So I decide to book it out of the house. We're in my own home. My mom's doing dishes or something. I run out the front door. We live in the country, and he ends up chasing me. And he ends up chasing me and gets us into – I kind of try to do this loop and get back in the house, you know, before he could do something to me. And this is the most angry I have ever seen him
in his entire life. How long does this all go on for the chase?
2-3 minutes, okay. 5 minutes maybe. I don't know. It seemed a lot longer, but it probably wasn't.
It's not like he was hunting you or stalking
you. No, I ran like 3 acres. Right. So whatever it takes to run 3 acres, I don't know. So – and I ran back, got into our property onto our acreage, and he just started beating the crap out of me. And then I made it to the back door, pounded on the back door, my mom opened it, and he punched me right as my mom opened the door. And that was the first time she'd ever really seen anything. And that was the last time he was ever in my life. That was it. That was the final straw. And she went through the entire process of breaking up with him, which for her ended up basically about 6 to 9 months she was in. She was in deep depression. It was a horrible, horrible experience in her life. And so she finally let go of that. And then that's when we kind of started talking about things. But even then I was nursing her into existence. I mean, she was depressed. She was suicidal. She was, you know, it was a horrible, horrible experience for her because this is the man that she had loved. And then in that process, he also ended up like, there's a lot of complicated issues of this, but he ended up cheating on her. There was like, they were going to try to put it back together. There was all this kind of stuff. So I ended up seeing him about My son is 7. So I ended up seeing him about 6 years ago in a department store randomly in Utah. And I remember walking around just thinking like, do I confront him? Like, what do I do at this moment? I haven't seen him for years, like 10 years, 15 years. I haven't seen this guy. What do I do? And very similar to talking about before, when I saw my stepfather who sexually molested me, you know, you have those moments of like, I'm going to go confront him. I'm going to go tell him that you ruined my life. You did all these things. And it was, again, just that moment of like, no, I'm not going to give it any more attention. I'm not going to focus on it anymore. There's nothing he can say that can make it better. There's nothing I can say that can make it better. I really don't care about anything. But the only gratifying thing I had in that was that his body language, the woman that he was with, everything about who he looked like, and again, total judging, but what he looked like, he was miserable.
Broken down. And you said the same thing about the first guy too.
And I don't know if that was like blinders for
like
me.
You know, needed that. Like
that
you
I
put
needed that,
on him.
But it was something.
At least he wasn't this bigger than life ogre that he was when
exactly.
he was going after you. You see him more realistically, which God knows maybe he was even back then.
Who knows?
You know,
right.
As a kid, you idealize stuff.
So it was but that period of my life was the most haunting because so much focus was put on the zero to 10, we'll call it, right?
Yeah. Well, let me give you an objective sort of viewer sort of experience of that because from the listener, I'm sure listeners are experiencing this too, which is that for those of us listening, it's like, no, that 0 to 10 was we could barely listen to it. But for you, and so people need to understand, first of all, your experience is valid. It's your experience.
Right.
And the reason it was vivid for you I'm sure there are multiple other factors we could weave in, including the fact that there was – I don't know if the many caretakers back in the 0 to 10 made it better or worse. But but after that, you were sort of a family and you were trying to form a family and it was desperately meaningful and intense for you to have a family and then to have it so back and forth into the old abuse. And it literally must have torn – sort of the fabric of yourself a little bit, that sort of here it goes again. How did you reconcile that?
That was the hardest part because
you know what I'm talking
100%.
About? Yeah, try to explain to people what I'm talking about.
Because the thing was is it's like you said, there was so much attention put on the 0 to 10. Right?
Yeah.
Because there were the science nerds who were like, how the hell? Right?
Yeah.
There were the counselors that were like, oh my gosh, I want a hero. I mean,
what are we going to do with this subject?
Right.
Both the heroes and the science guys.
Exactly. And so it just became – that was a fascination for people. And then there was also like he's functioning, you know, because at 17, 18 years old, I'm still talking about 0 to 10, but I'm talking about it in a way that's – it's almost apathetic. I'm almost just like – like, can we – no
well,
one was
well,
talking.
Well, that's what I was going to – sort of where I was going with that a little bit, which is that to some extent, maybe they did help you with 0 to 10 and they helped you process it.
Right.
And you did kind of get through it. And this new challenge was sort of a new vivid experience that no one was helping you with.
And it was totally solo because I couldn't talk about it.
Even your siblings were gone too. You're probably worried about them.
And even in counseling sessions, I didn't bring it up.
Oh, my God.
If I brought it up to a counselor, I was terrified they would tell my mom.
Or the state or whatever.
Exactly. The state. And that's the other thing people have to remember. And again, talk about this to some level on stage is that if I was in a ward of the state. Everyone has to realize.
You were or you were not?
I was.
Even when your grandma was taking care
of
you?
Yes, because she was only a guardian. So thus, the state was always checking in on the house.
So you were afraid you'd go back to foster?
100%. I would be pulled out. So, and this is when I'm learning how to treat women. This is when I'm learning how to incorporate my manhood, get air quotes, into the world. So there was a lot of residual damage from that because I was in this position of trying to figure out how to be a man, trying to figure out how to be a human being, trying to figure out how to love other people, and all I saw was abuse. Now, I've never abused.
But it wasn't all you saw. That's what made it so difficult.
Right. Yeah, exactly right. But
I'm wondering if the way you say it is part of what I was talking about, the fabric tearing apart. It's like when you're in the abuse, you're all in the abuse. And when you're in the love, you're all in the love. They're like two different selves almost experiencing the world.
And if I hadn't have had that started to understand that clarity and started to understand
how? That's what I want to know. How'd that happen?
Well, as we talked about in that first episode of just understanding the human body.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break here to talk about our friends at True Car.
When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. A lot of times that is not the case. People configure cars online only later to find out they are not available. Not with TrueCar. Of course, I'm talking about TrueCar. You get real pricing on actual inventory. This is not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from an actual dealer. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is a carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Yeah, you know, and we talk about it all the time. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar, TrueCar.com or TrueCar app will show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. Over 3,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers are available nationwide. You will get to work directly with a TrueCar Certified Dealer that you make contact with, and TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a faster, better buying experience when they contact a TrueCar Certified Dealer. And on average, you can expect to save over $3,000 off MSRP. Once you register, you'll see a real price on actual inventory. Hook up with that TrueCar certified dealer. Have a better buying experience. TrueCar, go to the TrueCar.com or TrueCar app.
All right, let's get back to the program. Did you still had therapy then, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, the timing.
And you had your mom,
right.
Quotes.
And the timing of it may have been perfect because there was a man that came into my life, Wade Smith. If anyone knows Wade Smith, living in Idaho Falls, call me immediately. Like, email me, wes@wesleydchapman.com. He's since retired and he's a counselor, so he's insanely protected about where he is, and he's not in the, you know, technology generation. Wade Smith came into my life very, very simultaneously to this 16-year-old kind of awakening moment.
Yeah.
I might have been 14 when I first met him. And Wade used a $12 basketball. And that was it. Yeah. I looked forward to seeing Wade, tearing up a little bit, thinking about these moments because he didn't give a shit about my past. He only cared about me, and we played basketball for an hour and 45 minutes. He taught me how to play like basketball. To me, I'm not the best at it, but it's that place. I can go and zen out on a court, and I did. I would play basketball religiously for hours and hours and hours and hours. There's still people that slow down by my house to this day because I'd be out at 2 o'clock in the morning playing in the driveway, and so people knew, like, Wes plays basketball. We're a little farm community, so, like, slow down a little bit. But it was, and that's another thing. I wanted a basketball hoop. Harry finally got me one, and we have an acre property, okay? Just want to make sure this is clear, everyone. An acre property. We have half an acre of just grass. You could have put a gravel thing in. We could have poured cement, whatever. He decides to cement mount a basketball hoop 7 inches from the barrier of the road, and that's where my basketball was. We've actually now had to move it because ordinances and all that stuff. He literally wanted me to play in the middle of the street. And
so,
it was,
every time you missed a backboard, your ball would go in the street.
Go in the street. And then, of course, it's a farm road and notorious, like,
oh,
you know.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So these are little things that, like, oh, that's not a big deal. It was a big deal, right? So it was a great hoop. It was amazing. But here's the thing. It's going to be, you know, 7 inches from the freaking easement of the road. So,
but you said you were going to tell us what happened to this Harry, what his history of abuse was or whatever.
So what we found out is he was married prior. So once my mom got healthy, you know, and she was back, she went to his ex-wife, and now she knew about me. So they had conversation and found that he was abusive to the other children, found out that his father was insanely abusive. So there was this
shocking.
There was this dysfunctional history, and he was just carrying it on.
The intergenerational transmission.
Right. Which is interesting is it doesn't transfer in sexual abuse, but it does in physical and emotional.
It can. A certain percentage.
2%.
Yeah.
2%.
It's not nearly like physical. Physical abuse goes through.
It's almost like 80%.
Yes. And the thinking is always the same, which is, I needed that. It was good for me. Mm-hmm. I was misbehaving. He knew what I needed. Kind of BS.
Right.
That's the bullshit that people believe. It's crazy.
It's insane.
And then they'll quote the Bible and stuff.
Right.
You know, spare the rod.
Spare the rod.
Spoil the child. It's like, the Bible also said just stab people in the head sometimes. Or don't. Yeah. They all kinds of crazy shit in the Bible.
If we're gonna listen to the Bible, there's a lot of crazy
shit
in there.
There's a lot of crazy stuff in there. You can cherry pick what you want, but come on now.
Yeah. So there was just these, like you said, conflicting moments. But for me, this is where I had to do a lot of the growth because I get past all of the trauma and the abuse.
Well, it makes
and all
sense
that
there was somebody there. Again, this is the point I keep making. It's one person.
Yes.
One other brain right there for you.
But how the interesting part about the one is that every one that's been in my life has not been some – I don't want to use this word inappropriately, but they haven't been some, you know, special, like, amazing,
no,
like,
doesn't know.
PhD,
no,
three masters.
Great observation.
That's the thing.
There's a guy named Peter Fonagy that was out. He was trying to figure out why some, well, highly trained mental health professionals have great outcomes and some don't.
Yeah.
And he went to try to find – he said, the therapist with the most efficient and best outcomes. And he looked all through the United Kingdom and he finally found this woman that had universal acclaim. Everybody was magically better that she treated. And she took all kinds of different problems. And it was just some little lady in a village in the Cotswolds who just had a deep capacity for empathy and caring.
That's
and
it.
Listening and looking That's into other
right
people
there.
And attuning to people. Yeah. And that
and being
that's
present
it.
With and vulnerable with other people.
Yes.
And that
looking
was
into her. And I heard – I was listening to a podcast the other day about a guy was trying to make sense of a psychiatrist. He was saying, oh, I think it's you have to not just talk at people but talk with people and you have to listen. I said – and he talked about a certain kind of active listening or something. And I said, no. You have to be able to listen with your entire body.
Exactly.
Your entire you 100% body needs to
present.
Be – right. And that's something that occurs not very often and only if you've been either the object of that or something – has required you to sort of create that to survive whatever it is you've been through, and that's certainly your story.
I think you have to be able to call up empathy. In my humble opinion,
to be at that level. Well, to be fair, I mean, some people just need meds, and some people just need
right.
cognitive behavioral therapy. But to really bring an average traumatized person without, you know, other genetic biological kinds of things, to bring them into full recovery and full flourishing, it's profound empathy. You have to be in with that person. This guy, I'm thinking of this pod I heard, I can't remember the psychiatrist's name, but he said he was with this suicidal patient and he was sleep deprived and all of a sudden one day that he was looking at her and he found himself listening deeply and the room went black and white. And then he thought he was having a stroke, but he said he finally looked at her and went, oh, if this is what the world looks like to you, I understand why you're so suicidal. And if you do kill yourself, I will miss you deeply. But I certainly have a profound understanding of
right.
why you – and he said that she had not looked at him in a year of therapy and all of a sudden she looked up and looked him right in the eye
mm-hmm.
and went, thank you. You know,
yeah.
It's like, yeah, that, yes.
I've been validated.
It's like, hello.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And it's like, yeah, that's when the people connect. That's
mm-hmm.
when one person goes, oh, I see you. I see you.
That's it. And you know, so for me, it was that where this movie, 13 Reasons Why, just came out. And that's a huge piece of that movie. And we could talk about that for hours. And so much is getting, you know, lost in
that.
Why
do you think it's that?
It's that moment of I see you.
Who? Where did you see that?
That's at the last episode, but they build it in through – the whole thing is about she's not being seen, she's not being heard.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
little action turns into this whole entire, you know, craziness. And there's
are you talking
so
about,
many
when you
things.
Say I see you, are you talking about the thing with the therapist or the
no,
counselor or whatever it was?
No, it's the moment where Clay, I believe is his name, goes to the girl who's kind of all – like she's a cutter. I don't remember her name and she's kind of like punk rocked out and stereotypical, totally whatever,
yes.
you know, cliche.
The coffee shop
girl. Yeah. And at the very end, he walks up to her and so many people are belittling that. And they're like, it's not that simple. And I'm like, yes, if somebody's struggling with a mental illness, it may not be that simple, but it might be too.
Even if it isn't that simple,
it starts.
It gets the process going. That's right.
Yep.
And that's why whenever you've told your story to me, I go, who was there? Who is it? What happened?
Right.
What was the connection?
So
because
Wade Smith.
I really believe that. I believe that that connection has to occur for people to get well. That's why when you talk about the last episode, you talk about that moment in the rubber room
mm-hmm.
when you're like, enough. I'm going to bet there was somebody that did something.
You know, it's interesting. I've thought about that of like, what was I watching? What was I seeing? What movies was I listening
or who
to?
Who are the therapists? And maybe one of them caught you, you know, off guard in a moment.
The biggest
maybe
thing
a nurse
that I,
at that hospital or something.
Right,
who the hell knows?
The biggest thing I remember was the two Mormon missionaries just taking time. And so I don't know. You know, it was just those two.
Who were they? I don't remember this.
There were two Mormon missionaries that visited the hospital, and they were the ones that like sat and read the Bible with me. We talked about religion, and again, just to reemphasize, like I think there's a place for religion. How do I say this? But organized religion to me is missing the mark. You know, but I'm not a part of any organized religion at this point. But that was that kind of moment of me looking and saying there's something bigger, there's more to life than just this piece of it.
Did you meet other visitors there in addition to the Mormons?
Not that I remember. Okay. Not that I remember. I do know that there were like some families that came in and like interviewed me to see if I'd be a good fit for their family. I mean, there was that kind of stereotypical crap, but like they were the ones that stood out. I still have vivid memories of what they look like, what they were wearing.
So isn't that interesting?
So that could have been the moment. I don't know, but I've racked my brain. The only other massively vivid thing, which I don't think has anything to do with it, but maybe, is the game Asteroids. Because there was a little room in the hospital. They had a pool table, Asteroids, and Pac-Man, and I became the king of Asteroids.
Like, was there anybody you played with or alongside of?
No, it was just me.
I wonder if that was just sort of mindful stuff for
you.
Yeah,
and then I became really good at pool, and I would play against all the nurses and stuff. Mm. And they had quarters. There's like a ton of stories. We'd get quarters for being good, and then you could exchange those quarters for going on field trips and like so many pieces.
Let's go back to the Mormons. Do you think, let's say, let's sort of tread into some controversial territory. Do you think that they had such a deeply spiritual sort of whatever connection that somehow that peace was coming through them to you?
Think about what the Mormon missionaries do. Like they, at the prime of their life, quote unquote, 19 years old, these boys and girls go out and spend 2 years serving other people. Right?
It's amazing.
Yeah. Let's forget the religion part. Let's just focus on what they do.
Yeah.
That's pretty selfless. That's pretty giving and very vulnerable. Like this is their time. Like this is biologically for the boys. It's like the time to party and have fun. It's the discovery zone for the girls, the frontal lobe development. This is like the prime freaking time of their lives and they're giving it to others. So the fact that that's happening, there has to be some energy happening there mm-hmm. that makes somebody feel comfortable and content, which would mean to me, if we want to really dive into it, why they have such good success when they go into impoverished areas and get people to trust and believe in them and see hope. Because
so again, that's the connection. Again.
That's that connection, vulnerability.
It's not the church or the book. It's the person to person.
It's the person to person thing. So yeah. To me, I could see myself at this age, no one gave a shit about me, right? There's not people loving me. Here's these two, and they're men. Right? Here's these two random men who are coming and giving me an insane amount of time. Now, wouldn't it be interesting? Because to me, it felt like multiple occasions.
Do you remember their names? It's put out for them.
I wish I did. Yeah. I wish I did. But
hey, here, well, describe the situation, date and location.
So this would be when I was seven and a half years old in the Primary Children's Hospital in Utah.
Primary Children's Hospital in Utah, mental health unit.
Right. And I was, there were two of them, both brunettes.
This is how many years ago? 20?
So 20 years ago, 20-ish, 19 years ago, they would be serving in the Salt Lake City mission, so the Salt Lake City, Utah mission. And yeah, so if you know anyone that served there, that fits that description, wore a dark suit, white shirt.
Wesley D. Chapman.
Yeah.
What's your email?
Yeah, right. WesleyDChapman.com.
Hey, it's time for me to talk about our friends at Alliant. Very cool organization.
The field of psychology is vast. The need for competent practitioners has never been greater. So if you're considering this rewarding career, I suggest you consider the California School of Professional Psychology at Alliant University. I've known Alliant University for years now. I'm proud to have spoken at their events in the past. It was founded in 1969, boasts an alumni network of nearly 50,000 individuals working worldwide, and it's fostered many of today's mental health pioneers, authors, and advocates. CSPP at Alliant University hosts both on-ground and online programs in business psychology, marriage and family therapy, and clinical counseling. They also offer an APA-accredited doctoral program in clinical psychology that allows for specialization in child psychology, clinical forensic psychology, and integrated psychology. Their faculty is made up of industry leaders, and former faculty names include the likes of Abraham Maslow, Carl Rogers, Viktor Frankl, some of the true fathers of modern psychology. So for more information on the School of Professional Psychology at Alliant, click the Alliant banner on my site or visit alliant.edu. That is alliant.edu.
Well, the rising cost of prescription medication is no joking matter. It concerns me not just as a doctor, but as a patient. That's right. Listen, I have to take a bunch of medications for my cholesterol and having prostate cancer and whatnot, and my blood pressure. But even with good insurance, the price of medication has become a big concern for most of us. I know, geez, when I see the actual price of the medication as well as what I have to pay, I'm stunned every time I have a prescription refilled. And with patients, they complain, I have to worry about it. It's an issue. Well, let me introduce you to RefillWise, R-E-F-I-L-L-W-I-S-E, a prescription saving card that you can get on your phone right now for free. No sign up, no wait time. Save on your next prescription. Simply use your mobile phone. Text Drew, D-R-E-W, to the number 22822. Again, that's Drew to 22822, and you will immediately receive your RefillWise prescription savings card ready to use. Just show it to your pharmacist and see how much you can save for your prescriptions. It works with major pharmaceutical companies to establish discounts on the price of over 6,000 commonly used medication. Right now, more than 1 million people are using this card. The average savings, 40%, and some up to 80%. I use it. So if you have medication not covered by insurance, make sure to check the RefillWise price at your pharmacy. Even if you have insurance, the RefillWise discount might actually be bigger, so it always pays to check before you check out. Also, I'm thrilled that for every new user, RefillWise will donate $1 to the Prostate Cancer Foundation, a charity that is very dear to my heart. Check them out at pcf.org. To learn more about RefillWise and see if your medication could be covered, check out refillwise.com. But to start saving right now, just text DREW, that's Drew, to the number 22822. Again, that's 22822. Message and data rates may apply.
And it's time to get back to the program.
Yeah, right? Wes at WesleyDChapman.com. But here's the thing. What would be interesting is I remember that being several touch points. How crazy would it be if it was one? Like, just stop and think about that for a minute. I'm gonna go and say they only came once.
Wow.
But I don't know.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
To me, it felt like multiple touch points. They came, cared, read with me, did stuff with me, played with me, did stuff with me, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say they only did that once. But
let's say it was twice. Let's say it was three times.
Right.
It feels
but
like 100.
My brain turned it into hundreds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What's the power of being nice to somebody one time?
It'll amplify.
Right? Like, yeah. Because they had no idea what my childhood was. Like, no one did. But yeah. Here they were giving, and my brain translates that. Now, even as an adult, if I wrote it in a book, I could write chapters and chapters about my experience with them and like literally fill up pages and pages and pages of a book. But what if we find out they only came one time for 1 hour? So when you think about, oh, I can't do anything, I can't make a difference, fuck that. Like you just going and spending. So kind of negates my thing I said before about like being there, but
it's different.
This is different.
Those people didn't claim that they were going to be there
exactly.
For you.
Exactly.
They made a connection. And the big brother or whatever is somebody who's saying, I'm going to be there for you.
I'm going to be there for you.
It's a different thing.
Right.
And also deeply important, profoundly important.
Yes,
but
massively.
Different.
So again, you know, now here I am battling through these things that Harry left me with, which was traumatic. And it made me not a good husband. I never was abusive. I want that to be very clear. I'm like insanely, insanely conscious of that. However, I have a temper, and I was lucky enough to realize, take that temper to sports, take that temper to work, take that temper to, you know, chopping wood, like get rid of it in other ways. I had enough experience and research to understand that you can't control that, right? Like there's not like, oh, I'm going to breathe three times. Yeah. Like at some point you're going to blow, right? So I would go and do that in a healthy way, but in my social connections, in my relationships, in the way that I loved people, I was not like anyone that worked with me from like 1999 to 2005. I'm sorry. Cause like I was an asshole when it came to like working because I didn't tolerate anything but perfection.
I was a little bit that way too.
Yeah. So it just, there was so much of
and
this.
And by the people who were around me make now start writing and say, no, he was very much that way.
So it's just like.
Because it's what you ask of yourself.
It's what I was asking myself. And it was this training that I had. And there were so many different pieces that I had to consciously be aware of, take ownership of, and then find the right way. And I'll never forget, I was 20 years old and I sat down with a guy who was mentoring me, and he said, Wes, and again, where this inspiration came from, I do not know. He didn't know my childhood. He didn't know anything. He met me one night.
This guy you were mentoring or he was mentoring
you? He wasn't even a mentor. It was just I was going to meet this – going to dinner at this random guy's house with a friend, and we were just going to have a dinner,
this
right?
This is when?
I was 20 years old.
Okay.
So walk in, go into his house, and he's, you know, 80-year-old guy, right, who's lived this amazing life, very wealthy. They like to talk and give you advice, right? You old men just love to just open your mouth and give advice. But here I am, and he doesn't know a damn thing about me. And he just looks at me and he says, Wes, there are going to be many men that come into your life who are going to claim that they are there to mentor you, that they're there to help you, there to grow. And everyone at this point in my life, I'm 19, 20 years old, there was something there about me. Everyone knew. I've been told more times than I can count, you're either going to be homeless living in a ditch or you're going to be a multimillionaire and everyone's going to know your name. There's no in between for Wes Chapman, which is like a curse and a blessing at the same time. And he tapped into the same weird energy and I just started kind of getting used to it, right? And so he's sitting there and he's saying, men are going to come in and out of your life, professing that they're going to be there for you. They're going to mentor you, father role. And I'm like, and I'm still in this lying stage of my life where I'm like, don't tell me, like, you know, my dad was great. Like, you know, he's saving whales in Africa. Like, let's just not, whatever. And he said, I want you to.
So you were completely fabricating the dad at that point.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Oh.
And so, you know, he said, I want you to ignore their weaknesses and focus on their strengths. And it was this moment of me kind of like internally going, oh my gosh, I needed that. Externally being like, shut up. Like, I'm good, you know, whatever. And I've never forgotten that advice. And while there's a lot of holes we could poke into it, the beautiful part of that was is that there have been so many people that have come into my life and tried to do things. I've even had people like text me and be like, you know, consider me your dad. And they hit that point in me and they know what they're doing. And then they end up being people that were not good for me in business, not good for me in personal life. But now I'm able to look at them and say, I'm going to forgive you, quote unquote. I understand you have weaknesses, but there were some really good things that I learned from you along the way. And that's enabled me to continue trusting specifically men. But that one piece of advice, that one dinner, it was just, it's always stuck with me.
God, it makes me think about a sort of a new men's movement a little bit. Because the other one to me always felt full of like platitudes. But there may be something more or a book or something for men. Put that on a shelf.
Yeah, I think there's so
there's
much.
There's something more we could do here.
There's
with that.
So much we need to do. And to me, it comes down to get real, have real conversations. That is one of the biggest reasons why I'm so fucking vulnerable.
Yeah, but a lot of people, you're in a state where you don't really know what that is. I mean, what if that old man had said that to you that night? You'd be like, fuck you, whatever.
Well, and I did, you know, but it stuck with me. And that's the thing that I say all the time is you don't know what's going to stick to people.
Yeah.
They may externally act like it doesn't. And I've had that happen. I've literally sat with children, you know, young adults who aren't listening to me. Their heads are down. They're on their phone. They're flipping me off. They have the hoodie over them, whatever. 6 months later, I get an email from them that says, you changed my life. And I've done that enough now that I just keep talking even though whatever because I know they're listening. You know, if they put headphones on, that might be different. I've had my experiences where, you know, I'll politely ask them to take them out, you know, whatever. Then second time, it's a little more stern. They can pretend they're ignoring, but they're not. And even your own children, you think they're not watching your fights.
Oh,
you
no,
think
they're
absorbing like
everything.
You can't believe.
Absorbing their antennas. Well, we have to start moving towards wrapping up. Did we get through everything? Or
we got through the bulk of it. I mean, and I've been getting the emails, as I'm sure your team has too, of like, how do I overcome?
Well,
how
that's what I want to get before we finish. That's what
exactly.
I want to get into. I want to go back to the Mormons. Did they talk about heroes and victims?
They
tell stories
about
heroes
stories.
And victims?
Yeah, Nephi, which is one of their Joseph Smith. I mean,
hero story. Everything's a hero story, but.
Right. I would say Nephi is probably one of, and Mormon, you know, the whole thing is they're all heroes. They're warriors that fought against evil, and Nephi fought against his own family. His own brothers want to destroy him, which is kind of ironic, you know, like I've had those moments. So, again.
Oh, your brothers came after you?
Not after me, but, you know. They're not brothers, right? Like I don't have family in the sense of like.
But who are the ones you wanted to protect so much?
That would be my handicapped brother and then my half brother. But
and,
I mean,
and they've come after you?
No. That's not what I meant. Oh. But I'm saying that you know I don't. I have last count like 15, 16. I don't even know how many siblings.
I see.
And they're none of us are really close, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So. And if you study heroes, again, they all seem to kind of be alone, right? They all seem to have these moments. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it they do themselves. A lot of it is their job. I mean, Spider-Man, Iron Man, Superman, they all – Thor. Like look at Thor and his brother. Like I mean it's just – these stories all have similarities. And so Nephi and his brothers, like there are stories in every religion, every tradition, every belief, and they're all very, very similar. Mm. They all have this and that's what I've studied and I've seen that it just doesn't really matter. Hercules, you know, like Zeus, like all of them have kind of this line that connects
like this,
them all.
The country needs something like this.
They do. And we've seen.
But the I couldn't save them part confusing me a little bit.
In what aspect?
Where we find that. And how people find that.
Well, if you think about some of the great leaders we have had in this country, how many of them went to war? How many of them battled? Let's just start at the beginning, George Washington. Mm. How many times do you think George Washington held someone in his arms that was literally dying and he couldn't save them, and now you want him to lead our country? And I mean, I don't know. I'm not there, but I would attest that almost every hero has had a moment where they weren't enough to save someone else, and that drives them. And what I mean they weren't enough is they didn't have the right tools. They didn't have the right expertise. They didn't have the right equipment, right? Like Iron Man didn't have the best suit in order to do XYZ, so he goes into his laboratory and he doesn't eat and doesn't sleep, and he builds the best suit and he fixes that problem. I think that's part of the motivation. I find it in myself. I find it in the stories. There's always that piece.
How do we get them? How do you answer? How do you respond to those emails?
Every one of them is different, but in the exact language, but it all comes back, and I know, you know, we've talked about this before, is are you willing to make that choice to continue making the choices, right?
But like, I don't think people can get to that bottom where they can't see their reality. Right.
They have to have, I call it hope. They have to have an understanding.
They have to have a person. They have to have a connection.
They have to have a hero.
Another hero.
Well, so again, even me going back, we're trying to figure this out. You know, let's just say it was a Book of Mormon character or Superman, whatever, doesn't matter. I had something. I had something that I was aspiring to, something that I was pushing forward, something that I was saying, look, that person went through hell.
Maybe this is a point for God and religion without organized religion. I know you're circumspect about that, but maybe there's some sort of something.
I think it's incredibly important. And the only thing that stops it from being effective is greed. Is power, is people's narcissism, is people's greed. When is enough enough? You know, we could go into that for hours. You have to come at this selfishly. Like, how much money could Superman have made if he said, hey, I'm Superman and I can do all this?
Yeah, I'm going to go to the bank and too bad on you all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, how much money could Iron Man make? I mean, how much money could Spider-Man make? You start looking at that on a marketing level. They could have been ridiculously wealthy. All of them chose not to have wealth over helping the community, helping the city. Batman, same way. Some of them had money before, whatever, but they could have made more money with their superpowers, right? And so when I look at that, I look at it, and that's where my model is of saying, look, there, yes, we need to be covered. Yes, you know, my family needs to be fed. Yes, we need help. Like, we have not needed as much help as we do now than we've ever had before because
the
organization, Human Project.
Okay.
I mean, we need donations. We need people helping because it's growing exponentially. And it's not just something I'm doing on the weekends anymore. Like, we're in 15 countries. We're millions of kids. Like,
and what's the end game? Other than helping lots of people, what's the sort of structural, you know?
The structural end game on as simple as we can is build an army of people.
No, I mean in terms of the institution of a human project. Is it schools? Is it research? Is it all the above?
It's all the above. I will say it's building this army because if last year we ran our camp. We do a camp every year. We had 20 plus kids come to the camp. Those 20-plus kids went to all corners of the United States and went back into their communities. They then recruited other kids. The conversations get started. Things start happening. Movements start happening. Families start awakening. And that's just one micro example. We've done this over and over and over again.
You want to do that in multiple locations, that kind of thing.
All over the world and have millions of children get this opportunity to have that hero woken up. And we need adults to do the same thing because we need them to support the children. So it's not just about kids. It's about human, which is why I didn't call it SaveTheKids.org. It's called a human project.
And in terms of waking it up, what does that mean? Procedurally, what does that mean?
Procedurally, it means seeing that individual that has maybe similar life or worse life or whatever you need, right? Everyone's different. And then seeing that they've done something. Mm. And I call this hope. It's the understanding. It's choosing clarity over insanity. Most people look at hope and say, someone's going to come and save me out of this burning building. It's a misrepresentation of the word. It's using it incorrectly. And you and I both love words, and people just throw out words, and they don't understand the power of words.
Yeah.
Hope to me is understanding that you can see somebody else doing it, and you now have a path. You have a way. I use this analogy. You're running through the forest. The forest is your life. You get to the river, or you get to this lake, right? So you're standing on the shore, and you see this island in the distance, and on the island's a party. That's the life you want. Right? You're standing on the shore and you're saying, where the hell's the boat? That's how most people look at life. Where the hell's the boat? You stand there for an hour, 10 years, okay, whatever. And all of a sudden, all the other people start running through the forest and a group of people jump into the lake and start swimming. Then you see them get up on the island and you see them partying. And then this is where you have to make the choice.
But think about how much easier it is to do the swimming than if you're there by yourself.
Right.
Because
right.
You've seen it's possible.
Exactly.
B, they did it without getting harmed. If you're
right.
scared, there are no sharks. That's
yep.
possible.
All the things.
I mean, all those things you wouldn't even know
no.
if you're just standing there by yourself.
Right. So now you see somebody else or a group of people swimming to that
yeah.
island. And now this is where you have to make this choice. Do I wait for the boat or do I see there's no sharks? They can do it. It's possible. Da, 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 da. And jump in. Hmm. What if the lake was only waist deep, and the whole time you sat there for 10 years waiting, you could have walked to the freaking island? And that, to me, is where I finally come to terms with my story is swimming across the lake. I'm showing people I don't really care. Like, yes, there are people who have had way more traumatic childhood experiences than me. I've met them, and it's not about comparison.
I would argue you're even taking the ones that can't swim across.
I would argue there's – yes.
Because you're showing them they can't.
Can.
Even though they have major issues with swimming or water or whatever, mm-hmm. you'll take them across.
I'll take them across to a point, but they have to put effort in. So maybe, to your analogy, they're kicking, right? They're
right. You won't make it together unless somebody
then unless do they're doing something. I'm
I
not going to carry
you.
Them.
I agree.
I'm not your savior.
Yep.
But I will help you and I will stand by you, which goes back to my original point.
Why the self-help groups? There's a, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, what's Anthony Robbins' thing is, I'm not your savior. But from a neurolinguistic processing standpoint, you don't process the not.
Yeah.
I am your savior is what's being said there, right?
And NLP, so, my friends, NLP.
Yeah, look at NLP. We'll talk about that next.
Yeah.
Do you have any NLP training? Do you have
self-training?
Yeah, I have very little myself, but I recognize the obvious stuff when I see it, and that's
oh, yeah.
one of those examples.
But to me, if you're listening to this and you're struggling with life, and I don't care. I don't care how extreme or not extreme. It's your life. It's a struggle. It's relevant. I validate that struggle. If you're struggling with that, just look around at people who have done what you're trying to do and realize it's possible. Limitations are self-appointed.
And I would say go find somebody that you – somebody
yes.
different that you feel that – who can see you.
Right.
Who you can tell your story to, and they will sit and see it.
And see it. And this yeah. is – you know, even since our last conversation, I've decided to go all in on this Wake the Hero, right? And I'm building an entire program that – can help individuals get through this. So if you're interested in that,
it's a big deal. It's a big concept, and I'm kind of hoping that our entire country gets somehow.
I think it's either going to happen as a conscious awakening, or biology and history are
yeah,
going
right,
to do it itself.
Right, and I hope you're right. But what I'm saying is not that you and I are going to somehow wake the country up. What I'm saying is this country kind of needs a new archetype, and I'm wishing that the archetype is sort of a new. Mobilized self, mm-hmm. hero, for lack of a better way of describing it. I don't know if it's a magician or what. I don't know what their type is, but something that's self-sufficient,
yeah,
and something that's inspired. Something, you know what I mean? We need that.
We 100% need it.
All right, my friend. It's always a privilege, and I know the listeners love your stuff, and I'll be very interested to see how they react to this, because this was. Comprehensive
yeah.
in terms of where we went, where we got.
There's just
where we
so
got.
Much that we can continue.
Yeah, so, well,
in.
That's thus the project. So be a part of that if you want to be. And
yeah.
And you and I'll probably do another one at some point, you know, as more stuff evolves with us.
Right.
And in the meantime, thank you very much. It is Wesley D. Chapman is the Twitter handle at WesChapman.com, WESChapman.com is where you can follow him on the website. And you get into the stuff on the website too?
Yeah, we're building all that out. So join
right.
the email list and
check
let's,
it out.
Let's have some
all
fun.
Right. And I'll see you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in 1 offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save big money.